Clancy is the managing director of the Midnight Mission. He spent most of his adult life in the colorful field of advertising and public relations, working with assignments ranging from putting words into the mouth of Elsie the cow to the frantic world of Hollywood, radio, and television. This is your bio. Someone wrote this. In 1974, however, he took his most unusual career step when he resigned his post as the marketing director for a Beverly Hills publishing firm to become the managing director of the Midnight Mission in the heart of Los Angeles' Skid Row. For the past 28 years, he has continued as a supervisor of the facility under the direction of a 14-person board of directors. Since the appointment of Larry Adamson as president and CAO in 1998, Clancy has remained on the board to assist in the development of public relations for the mission. The University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire named him their Distinguished Alumnus of the Year in 1980 for his work in the field of alcoholism. And the Reader's Digest also ran a six-page spread on Clancy's work in Skid Row. Clancy is married and the father of 5 grown children, but 11 grandchildren and a great-grandson now present most of the excitement around the house. He lives with his wife of 52 years in what he describes the conservative end of Venice, California. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Clancy Emmislin.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here this morning, glad to take part in this presentation. It's taken, how long have they been doing this, 27 years? 27 years to get an invitation. It's been a long time. I think I was thrown off from the start. Many years ago, Dr. Persh, who ran the Naval Hospital in Long Beach, called me. I used to go and talk to his hospital twice a year. He said, "We have Mrs. Ford as one of our patients. And the president is going to go to a meeting with her. And tell me where you're talking. I want you to give a talk on what alcoholism is so he'll understand it, and I'll send him to that meeting." I said, "Okay." And I gave him somewhere in the South Bay. And I went down there that night, Sunday night. I remember going in, and there sat Betty Ford and the president, and people, didn't know whether to, you know. But it's one of those meetings where the front rows, empty seats like there is here, and mope standing in the back around the door. So I tried to be... As usual, I said, "You people in the back, you're welcome to sit down here. There's seats open down here. Well, you won't get much standing back there. That be a part of things." And I continued my talk. And after the meeting, the secretary came up and said, "Those were the president's Secret Service men." So it's taken me 27 years to overcome that. I was in San Salvador yesterday noon having lunch, which is a long way from here. And I got back late last night and drove down here, and I want to thank Jerry for his hospitality. Very nice. And it was kind of a difficult trip. I had an even worse trip a few months ago, I must tell you. I was giving a talk in Reykjavik, Iceland, which is just about 1,000 miles beyond any length. And the worst part about it, you have to travel in Iceland Air, which is like Mexican State Railroad, just boom, boom, boom. And I got back to Minneapolis, and through the triumph of their scheduling, I had about a five-hour wait in Minneapolis on Sunday night to get a United Airlines flight to Los Angeles. And I was sitting around. I went to the red carpet room. I brought the red carpet room and sat there and had to go to the bathroom finally, which is all right. They have neat little two little stalls side by side. And I went in and did my business, and all of a sudden, a voice in the next stall said, "Hi there." I didn't know what to make of that. I just didn't say anything. I thought it must be. "What are you doing tonight?" I said, "Actually, I'm going to fly back to Los Angeles to be with my wife and children and grandchildren. And I've been kind of tired. I've had a long trip. Thanks for asking." There was a long pause. The voice said, "We could really have some fun tonight if you wanted to." And I was tired and cross. I said, "Really, I don't know what your problem is, pal, but just drop it. Just let it drop. Do what you're in here to do and get out of here. I want to just do what I'm in here to do and just drop it." Then there was a pause, and the voice said, "I'll have to call you back. The fool in the next stall won't shut up." All right. I was thinking this week in San Salvador, surrounded by a lot of AA members, and what a tenuous thing, how easy it is to take all of this for granted, even such as this treatment facility here, all the people that are sober, all the people all over that are sober. You know, there's been record of alcoholism for 5,000 years at least, written records, and now they found some dishes in Africa, some 7,000-year-old dish that they found alcohol trace of and so on. And everywhere there's been a written record of alcohol usage, there's always been some mention made of some small percentage of people who react differently, who act badly, who become bad. And at one time they thought they were possessed by devils and actually put them to death sometimes. And they scourged them and whipped them and flogged them and exiled them. England exiled any number of alcoholics to Australia to get them out during the colonization there. And south, and many of them were sent to Georgia. And you can still see the traces of it. But and then I have a book home that really has a touching picture in it. It shows a room where it looks like upright caskets. They're really little private prisons with a bunch of boxes, and there's a hole like this in front. And you, as you look over that way, you see the faces looking at you, and there's a back of a man who's talking to them. This was in 1866. Dr. Gianson treats a group of French alcoholics, just locked in their box and talking to them, and on and on. And now the most successful pattern wasn't successful at all. It was the Keeley cure, and most of you are too young to remember that, in the 1920s and 30s. And there's always been cures, and nothing has ever worked. In fact, in my lifetime, when I was a little boy up in northern Wisconsin, I didn't know it, of course, but there was no place for an alcoholic to go. There just was no place for an alcoholic to go. And most of us know that story about in 1931, this wealthy family in New York had a son who was about in his mid-30s, and he seemed to have a very bad nervous system, because every so often his nervous system would make him drink alcohol. And so they wanted to do something about it. And so they found the best psychiatrist in the world to send him to work with him. And that was Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take on the treatment. And we can all heave a sigh of relief for that. We'd be sitting here this morning dreaming about our sex life, you know. So they went to his associate who had just broken with him, Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung had a hospital sanitarium in Switzerland. And they sent their son over there, and the son went over there. And he worked with him every day for a year. He just got through to his conflicts and inner problems and situations. And said, I think now, Roland, Dr. Jung said, Roland, you think you can go back, and I think you can lead a normal life. So Dr. Roland went back, and on the way back, unfortunately, he stopped in Paris with his group of family, had no reason to not do it, and they toasted his success. And a few days later, he was face down drunk again in Paris, and everybody was shocked. He was, what happened to Roland? And the family sent someone, hired some people to take him back to Dr. Jung with a new blank check. This was the middle of the Depression. Blank checks were pretty hard to find. And they took him back. They said, could you treat him and take him back? And Dr. Jung refused to accept him back, which sounds kind of cold, but if he had, we might not be here this morning. But he said, I'm sorry, I can't take you back. And they said, why not? Roland didn't mean any harm. He said, no, that's not the point. The point is that I misdiagnosed him. I thought he had deep psychiatric problems I could help him with, but I see now that he is known as what is known as an alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for his condition in the world today at any cost. Now, that's kind of a bad news for 1932, I'll tell you. And Roland said, well, what does this mean, doctor? He said, what it means is this, Roland. You must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily for the rest of your life. Or otherwise, you will certainly drink to excess until you go mad or die. And he stunned Roland. He says, is there any other alternative? There have been a few cases in the literature where there's been an involuntary, massive psychic reversion inside. They call it some sort of a spiritual experience. He said, but I've never personally seen one. I guess they have them, but they're so rare, you'd have a better chance of being hit by lightning. I suggest that you do what I tell you, Roland. And Roland came home from that, and he got on the ship, and he didn't stop to toast anybody this time, and got on the ship. And on that ship, I suppose he did something that all of us have to do who are alcoholics, although he didn't know he was doing it. I think he surrendered to the fact he was hopeless and helpless. He didn't know what to do. And he got back to New York, and he'd been a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church. He was a semi-religious man. But he realized, I have to do, what can I do? I got to do something more to stay sober for a while. And there was an organization, we've all heard of it, called the Oxford Movement. The Oxford Movement was started temporarily, very small, in 1912 by a Lutheran minister in Pennsylvania. And it grew over the years and moved to England, and Oxford University and their environs embraced it, became known as the Oxford. The original name of it was the First Century Christian Association. He wanted people to return to the Christianity of the first century, where people were willing to die for their belief. And anyway, it got to be the Oxford Group and came back. And all through America and all through many civilized countries, there were little pockets in every of these cities. And it was kind of like S. You know, remember S? There's a group of people who'd get together and discuss psychological and psychiatric things. They got together and discussed spiritual things, matters of the spirit. These were not lower class people. These were upper class people, the wealthy people, the upper middle class. And Roland thought, maybe I could go to the Oxford Movement for a while. Maybe that'll help me. He went to the Oxford Movement, and he stayed sober. And he always said that he felt the Oxford Movement had kept him sober. But obviously, doubtful, because the Oxford Group had a lot of drunks in it that could not get sober. One of our founders, for example. But he stayed sober for a while. As he wrote later, I wanted to stay sober long enough so that my family would have a pleasant memory of me when I died drunk. And I'll tell you something, that's just the way it worked out. They had a pleasant memory of him when he died drunk. But he did very well for a long time. And his family loved him. They sent him up to their home in Vermont. They had homes in Vermont where they'd lived as youth, and so on. Just wonderful. And he just happened to be there by a coincidence. Awful great coincidence. So some of his friends, childhood friends, now grown up, came to him. You know, Ebby, our friend Ebby, he's in deep trouble drinking. He just can't get over it. Can you help him? He said, I'll try. So we talked to Ebby, and Ebby didn't want to hear, but I don't want to hear that. Come on, Roland, don't give me that religion crap. That's for somebody else. Okay. So the next week, Ebby was drunk again, ran his car into a guy's house. And this time he was in deep trouble because he had just violated his final probation and was going to be sent to the Vermont State Penitentiary. And a guy rushed over to Roland and said, Roland, look, my dad is the judge that's going to sentence Ebby. I can't even talk to him. But maybe you can, because he knows your father and he knows you and he knows that you're sober now. Can you come over and try to talk him out of it? He said, I'll try. And he went to court and acted as an amicus curiae, a friend of the court. And he said, if you'll release him to me, Judge, I'll take care of him. I used to drink too, and I don't drink anymore. The judge says, only because it's you, Roland, and your father. No one else would I do this for, but I know that you're honest and straightforward, but you must take him out of Vermont. You must take him out of here. If he stays here, he'll go to the penitentiary. So he said, okay, and he took him back to New York, and he stuck him in a mission down on Broadway that was kind of run by the Oxford Movement. And he kind of responded well, too. He wasn't really crazy about the Oxford Movement, but he was not crazy about going to the Vermont State Penitentiary either. And so he'd get along. And one of the things you have to do in the Oxford Movement when you're sober a little while, or doing well, he wasn't wanting to be sober, that was a side effect for him, is that you had to testify. You know how to go out and find someone and testify what you had found. And he didn't want to do this. Who wants to go out and testify to some stranger what you found? You know what I found? And he said, Roland, I don't want to do this. And Roland said, well, do you think you'd like to go back to Vermont and go to the penitentiary? He said, no, I believe I'll testify. So that, who could I testify to? And he thought, and he happened to think that there was a bozo even worse than him in New York that he used to know as a kid, who was really a bum living off his wife, and no good, couldn't hold a job, just a real nothing. He said, I'll get a hold of him. And he found this man, Bill Wilson, over in Brooklyn. He said, this is Ebby. Remember me, Bill? He made arrangements to come over and see him. So we went over and saw him. Now, in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they described this meeting. Bill said, I went to the door. Here he looks so well, and so on. I heard Ebby speak. I'm maybe the only one in this room that did. heard Ebbe speak, and he described it a little bit differently. That much of it is correct. He said he sat down with Ebbe, with Bill at the kitchen table. Bill did not mention that he kept pouring drinks and talking while Ebbe was telling him about it. That's really wonderful, Ebbe. Here's to you. And finally he got up and left, and this hurt Ebby's feelings. You know, I came here to testify, and this drunk outsmarted me. So he came back about 3 days later, and he had the Oxford Group closer with him. Mr. Wilson, I'll tell you about the Oxford Group. And Bill Wilson reacted like any decent person would. He went on one of the damnedest drunks of his life. And he wandered around town for a couple of days, even stopped at Ebby's mission to visit him one day. Ebbe wasn't there, but he gave a short sermon anyway. And staggered on down the street, wound up back at a hospital again, this town's dreadful town's hospital. And they called Lois, and Lois called Ebbe, and Ebbe took some guys down there, and they said, gee, Bill, you got to do something about this. Oh, I can't do it. You don't understand. So you got to find, I can't find God. That's ridiculous. And so in the middle of the night, Bill Wilson, of all the unlikely people in the world, turned out to be the one in a million or one in 100 million who had a true spiritual experience. And he didn't know what it was. All he knew was that the room seemed to light up and there was winds blowing, and he thought, I'm going insane, is what he thought. And the morning he told the doctor about it. The doctor said, I don't know what happened to you, Bill, but you look different. Hang on to it. So we came out of that hospital, and you may wonder why all this Ebbe and all this was necessary, having a spiritual experience, and then go do something about it. Nearly all of the people who ever had a spiritual experience, it was a very small number, always associated it with religion. So they would go to church and get in church work. And he somehow associated with Ebbe and being sober in the Oxford movement. So he went off to the Oxford movement. And for the next few months, he just worked, just enthusiastically, I've got a mission to help drunkards. And he would find street guys, street bums, and bring them to the Oxford group meetings. And, you know, these Oxford group people were not thrilled about that, you know. You seem to be vomiting on my shoe, sir. You know, lose a little of the magic. Once in a while, he'd find somebody who was really pathetic. He'd take him home and work on their sobriety. And he did this month after month. And at the end of 6 months, he had taken a guy home that night. And the guy had gotten up early, stolen something from the house and left, something to sell for wine. And Bill got up and saw this. How could they do this? And he looked at his wife, this little ex-society girl, now putting on her sweater with a little patch on the elbow to go to work as a counter girl in a sleazy little department store so she could make enough money so he could do all these things. And he said, that's it. I'm done. I've been working with people for 6 months. Not one person has stayed sober. What I thought was some inspiration, it was just craziness. I'm not going to do this anymore. Lois, I apologize. I'm sorry. I won't do it anymore. Not one person stayed sober. And she turned to him, and I'll tell you, right then, our lives hung by the thinnest of threads. And she turned to him and said a statement that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her one day in Hartford, Connecticut, a few years ago. I said, Lois, how did you ever think of that answer? So remarkable. She said, I don't know. It just seemed normal. What she said was, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. And he said, oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You go through life going, oh. So he tried it some more. And we all, most of us know the story from our own literature about how he finally got a job out in Akron. Somebody finally gave him a chance to go out there and set up a stock deal where he'd take control of a company and beat something. And he went out there and the whole thing blew up in his face, and he wound up in the standing in his hotel, Mayflower on Saturday morning, $10 in his pocket, hot day. And just can't go back. How can I go back to New York and admit I'm a failure? I'll never get another job. I don't have enough money to pay my hotel bill and pay train fare. And there's no place to get anymore. What am I going to do? I'm kind of a romantic at heart. I like to recreate things. Wednesday of this week, for example, I stood where Columbus discovered America. And I stood at that beach and tried to recreate what it was like when they came ashore. I remember standing in the Mayflower Hotel many years ago. It's now turned into a senior citizen center, but it's still a hotel. About where he must have stood. And over there, there's a door with a little curved sign that says cocktails in orange neon. And as he wrote later, he said, I had the feeling if I just had a couple drinks, perhaps I could figure out what to do. And he started towards that door. And again, our lives hung by a thread. God, we've got them all threads. And he got there and he saw out of the corner of his eye the telephones against the wall. And I don't know if many of you in small towns, I don't even feel they do it anymore, but they always used to do. They have a bank of telephones and over in all the local churches, so you know where to go to church. And he had promised his friends he'd call an Oxford group member. He didn't know any Oxford group members, Sacrament. So he called up the first guy and he said, I'm a rum hound from New York and I'm looking for someone to talk to in the Oxford movement. And the man said, I'm writing a sermon, sir. I don't really have time to help you. And hung up. And he called another guy then hung up. And I don't know about you, but I'm afraid a weekly guy may have said, well, I did what I said I would do. It's hot. Maybe if I just had a couple drinks. But he called the next one, Reverend Walter Tunk. And Reverend Walter Tunk, by coincidence, had a woman who was concerned about her drunken doctor. They were all in the Oxford group together. He said, call her together. He said, let me have your number. I'll have her call you. So he stood by the phone, and he called this woman, and the woman called. Thank God she was home. Thank God she was home. And she called Bill, and she said, yeah, I have a doctor who's the Oxford woman. He's a wonderful man, but he can't stay sober, and perhaps you could talk to him. He said, yes, I will. She said, let me call you back. And so she called. She hung up and called up Dr. Smith. And Mrs. Smith said, well, I'm surprised you should call. He just came home totally drunk. He's laying drunk under the coffee table. I can't possibly let him see anybody this way. But we can do it tomorrow. Thank God she was home. And she called back Bill and said, how'd you get out to her home? To the Sieberling Mansion in Akron. They were the heirs. She was the divorced wife of the heir to the Goodyear fortune. And she had a lot to do. So on Sunday morning, they gathered together in this room out there. Many of you know young Bob Smith, Dr. Bob's son. They call him Young Bob, but he's 78. He really isn't very young. But they called Dr. Bob, and I know him fairly well. You know, he and I've laughed about it over the years, but he's the only survivor of that meeting of any kind. And he talked about riding out there with his father and his mother and his sister. And his father's so tired of being preached at about his drinking. He said, Ann, I'm doing this for you, but I'm sick of being preached at. I'll give this guy 20 minutes and I'll be courteous. But then I'm going home. I don't want to sit through this. And they got out there, they met these two guys, met, and they went into a room and stayed there 4 hours. And they came out and Bob said, I can't believe it. That's the first man I ever knew who seemed to know how I felt and why I drank. He said, it's just remarkable. He said to Bill, could you possibly stay over a few days in Akron with us? And maybe we could talk and just a little while and you could stay with us. And Bill thought, well, let's see. I can't afford train fare out, so yes, I will do that. Huh? So he moved in with them and they sat and discussed spiritual matters and religious matters and breakthroughs of the spirit and metaphysical things for 2 weeks, and Dr. Bob blossomed. He came out of there and said, boy, I am so glad. I've never felt it. There's going to be an AMA convention in Atlantic City. I've not dared to go to one for years, but I'm going to go to this one and tell him what we found. He said, Bill, would you stay here with my wife and two kids? And they went off to Atlantic City, and Monday morning at 6 o'clock, they got a phone call from Mrs. Smith got a phone call. She said, I'm sorry, this is the doctor's office nurse. I got a call this morning at 5 o'clock from the station master that carried Dr. Bob off the train so drunk he couldn't walk. And I went down and got a cab, and he's lying on his office floor now. I don't know what to do, but I'm so sorry. He was doing so well. So Bill and Ann went down to get him, and they took him home, and they put him to bed. And again, our life hung by a thread again. And they talked, and Wednesday morning, the doctor woke up, and he said, oh, God, I'm so sick. He said, I'm so sick. What day is it? It's Wednesday morning, Bob. Oh, my God, I got to do a cancer surgery this morning, and I have to do it. I can't hold a knife. Look at my hand. So they got him up and bathed him and got him dressed and took him out, got him some alcohol so his hand would stop shaking. And he went down and did the cancer surgery. And when he put down the knife and the drink, that moment is what they consider the birth moment of Alcoholics Anonymous, June 10th, 1935. And they went home, and he didn't come home for quite a while. And he turned out that he had some Oxford group training had kicked in. He felt so different. And on the way home, he stopped and made amends to a bunch of people that he felt he'd hurt. and he never drank again. But the one thing, of course, they realized is that sitting around discussing spiritual matters is not what had kept Bill sober. It was trying to help other people. So they went up to Akron Hospital, and where Bill, Bob had a little clout still. They found a drunken guy up there named Bob D, or Bill D, who was a lawyer from Louisville. And he'd been drinking for years. You know, been grinding people. And his wife, I met her. She's a strong woman. She was grinding him. Well, now, Bill, suppose you're drunk. And I heard him talk a few years ago. He said, I was laying in that bed in Akron. And my wife came in and said, two fellas want to talk to me about drinking. And I thought, oh, hell. I don't want to talk to anybody about my drinking, but she's a rather strong woman, so I talked to them fellas. And them two fellas never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked to me about their drinking and how they felt. I never heard anything like that. It's just like me. It so impressed me, I stuck with them fellas. I've been with them ever since. And he became the third one of this nebulous chain. Then they tried to work with some people who did no good at all. But that pretty soon they had four or five people. Then they got a young guy, 29. And he that was all right so far. But then he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter and opened the Pandora's box in our organization called relationships. There's no word that any sponsor dreads worse than that. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. You then want to have an aha machine on your desk and go, yeah. And it's always, oh. And there, to this day, it still sends a shiver down my spine. You hear the, just the throb of sincerity. I know I thought the last one was the girl, but when I saw her coming out of detox, I... I know that we'll be happy forever. And you don't know whether or not to tell them the sad facts of life, that this is another one of your nonsense infatuations. But you decide to tell them. You have to try to tell them things like, nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. Nothing, cars, homes, relationships, nothing. Oh, no, this will be, I'll tell you something. We had lunch today, and we both reached for the salt. And our fingers touched, and I swear there was a spark. I saw a spark. And you don't know whether to tell them or not. This is a temporary effect. In the one in a billion chance that your relationship survives, and that you 3 years from now, you're married, and you have a little home and a little tight plague in the front yard, and you're living idyllically, and you'll have lunch, and your hands will touch, and you'll say, give me the goddamn salt. Just part of that. Just part of that. Well, anyway, he got involved with Miss Smith, and they got married. And as a result of him being married, they knew that as a newlywed, he shouldn't be doing all these things and going to hospitals and all these things. So they kind of gave him a pass on it. And they were saddened when he got drunk and died and made her an enemy of AA for the next 50 years. Well, anyway, little by little, and they got it going, and Bill went back to New York and got a little pocket of Oxford Group people there. And they, in 1938, they're deciding what to do with that. If we could just start some hospitals, if we had some hospitals, how can we get some dough for hospitals? We'll write a book. We'll write a book. And we'll put all the stuff we know in it, and we'll get some hospitals. So they wrote this book, and they sent a postcard to everybody in America, every doctor in America practically, saying, here's a chance to work with alcoholics. And they've waited and waited to go down to, to get all of them, and they found two postcards after a month. And it just didn't go at all, which was a fortunate thing for us, because they wouldn't have been able to handle it. And in 1940, somebody put a little article in Liberty magazine about Alcoholics Anonymous, which made it sound like a religious cult, so it didn't do much good. But then, most of us know this story. At the end of 1940, the Serbian Post had a reporter who specialized in exposing fraud. And he had just finished a great series of articles on the fraud at the Philadelphia waterfront, union fraud. And his next assignment was to work his way into this new thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and blow the whistle on them. And he went there and was much astonished to find out they were just what they said they were. Nobody was ripping off anybody. Nobody's doing anything. It's the closest thing to Christianity anybody had ever seen. And he wrote this glowing article, which, of course, made AA grow. And then all over the country, people were sending in cards and letters. There already was an AA group in Los Angeles that had started in 1939. That's a dumb little story. Might as well tell it. We have no place to go. A woman came out from New York in 1939, and her brother had gotten sober in New York. And she was so thrilled. She was an alcoholic, but he was. And she had a copy of the manuscript of the book. Not the book yet, but the manuscript. And she advertised in the Los Angeles paper, "Ladies, do you have husbands who have problems with alcohol? Call this number." And she got a few calls and got a dozen of them to agree to meet her at the Hotel Cecil down on Main Street in Los Angeles on the Sunday afternoon. So on the Sunday afternoon, 1939, she's waiting with her manuscript. And here come 12 women with their husbands. And they go up in the mezzanine. She's rented a room for them. She said, "I want you to just go to this room now, and here's this thing that'll save your life." So they went in. They said, "Aren't you coming in and tell us about it?" No, of course not. "No, I'm not an alcoholic. I can't do that. You must go in there, and you must have your own meeting." So they shut the door. And one guy named Morty Joseph, who later became a legend in Los Angeles, has been dead now, but I knew him when I was a newcomer, great man. They threw the manuscript in and said, "Well, why don't you look through this thing, see what's in there?" And he went through it. That's the table of contents, how it works. "That looks interesting." So they opened How It Works, and they read the first three pages and discussed it. And that is where the custom of reading chapter 5 came from. They didn't do it every meeting after that. In fact, up until 1960s, it only was done in Los Angeles. And now, little by little, it's all over the world. But it's an interesting thing. As they started, AA died out, but Morty Joseph stayed there, and he, through a series of breaks or whatever it might be, they had selected the nubbin of AA right there, and he always felt that, and he always read it whenever he started a meeting. But all over, you know, 1941, now they're coming in. Most of us know Sybil Corwin. She had a funny story about going to her first meeting, and they gave her a whole bunch of letters and cards from women in the Los Angeles area at her first meeting. Says, "Call on these women. I don't know anything. What do I tell them? Tell them to come to the meeting next week." And just little by little, it grew great. And now, exponentially, it's grown all over the world. It's now in 130-some countries, I guess. More than 2 million sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's everywhere that can be found, and highly successful. It is the only thing of its kind, the only long-term successful treatment for alcoholism in the history of mankind. It's easy to find. It's easy to deal with. In fact, the only time it was ever in any danger at all was in the mid-40s. In the mid-40s, AA started to come apart again because this flush of inflation from 1941 is going, and Bill Wilson didn't know what to do. He started the grapevine for something to do. Maybe that'll encourage him, big thing by that size. And AA, every day he'd see letters about our group is dying, our group is fighting over this, our group is fighting over that. All over AA, people were fighting. There are two schools of thought. The Akron was more into the Oxford movement with their four absolutes, and New York was away from the Oxford movement, and all over the country. People in Los Angeles would not write to Akron because they were a bunch of religious freaks, and the people in Chicago wouldn't write to New York because they were a bunch of highbinders, and just people getting drunk constantly. And a guy in North Carolina wrote an article for the Grapevine, sent in to Bill, and said, "I wish you'd read this. We're going the way of this group." And he talked to some about something called the Washingtonians, that just 100 years before it started with six guys who had, through zeal and pluck and grit, built themselves up to hundreds and then thousands. At the end of 5 years, were using many of the techniques they had of alcoholic talk to alcoholic. They estimated about 100,000 drunkards, sober drunkards in 1845, which sounds pretty good. You stop thinking AA didn't have 1,000 after 5 years. And then in 1845, they were doing so well and so successful, they begin to think something that sounds right, because people in AA talk about it today. They thought, if we could help drunkards, we should be able to help people with all kinds of problems. People who aren't drunkards, we should be able to help narcotics addicts who are not drunkards. not with heroin and cocaine like we have today, but then laudanum and opium. We ought to help people who are troubled in their lives. We ought to help people. We'll get into the, a lot of them got into the stamp out alcohol, temperance movements. Some of them got involved in abolition of slavery. Some of them got involved in allowing Texas into the Union. All over. It's just this. They put their tremendous, well, they fought a war about it, finally. Wasn't that all that funny? But all over the, all these people just began doing these things. And by 1848, the movement was extinct, and nearly every one of them died drunk on the street, a bad death. And I had a book home in 1961, written in 1861, where they survived one of the few prizes. Don't know what happened. People just lost interest in helping drunkards. They're helping all these people. We're all doing such good work, but one by one, we all got drunk. In effect, that's what he said. And so Bill Wilson saw that and saw what was going on around AA, the fights and battles, and he sat down in a desperate attempt to save Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1945, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions, based a large part on the Oxford, on the Washingtonians, and a large part of what they had. And he introduced them one by one in the grapevine. And the problem with AA in the 1940s is the same way it is now. It was full of alcoholics. We don't need laws, we don't need rules. We just want love and freedom. And a lot of people wouldn't take him. And he would travel around on his motorcycle with his wife with the sidecar to meetings. Came out here a couple of times to try to explain. We got to do this. We're dying. And it got to a point finally. Now, it sounds funny, but it's terribly sad when you think about it. They would invite him to come to speak. Bill Wilson at a meeting. Will you speak at our anniversary? But only if you promise not to mention the traditions. If you mention the traditions, we'd rather have you stay home. We'll get somebody else. And there, so by 1949... they weren't making a lot of progress. And Bill and Dr. Bob, their followers always didn't get along very well, but they got along well. And Dr. Bob and Bill got together and said, if we could just get all these warring factions in a room somewhere, and we're all doing the same thing, and all instead of fighting all the time, we could do something about it. And so they got their followers to find us a place to meet. And the people in Akron said, well, we'll go to a meeting, but we won't go to New York. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, said, we'll go to a meeting, we won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together and made a solemn and like decision.
Cleveland.
Okay. So in 1950 in Cleveland, they had the largest assemblage of alcoholics in one room in the history of mankind, of 5,000 years. At the first international convention. They didn't know it was going to be the first. They just called it a convention. And I have a picture of that, and I have the tapes of that from the back. Very interesting. The quality of the tapes is poor, but the content is great. They had mostly non-alcoholic speakers because they were trying so hard to get public acceptance. They had Warden Lewis E. Laws from Sing Sing and some doctors and ministers. And only two meetings was made up of alcoholics. One, of course, was... they had a big meeting on Sunday afternoon when Dr. Bob and Bill talked. And Dr. Bob at this time was dying of cancer. And they thought he probably wouldn't want to talk. But he said, oh, no, next to Bill, I've been with him for 15 years. So that day, his son and another guy took this tall, gaunt person to the microphone. And he gave a talk which many people feel is like the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was such a significant thing. He said, in effect, well, I'm glad to be here, and I welcome you to Cleveland. I hope you'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your groups that we're all here on the same, doing the same thing. He said, I'm happy that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. And he said, I want to apologize for my physical conditions. My health has not returned the way it was. He said, I do want to call attention to two or three things. And then he gave what many people, it was his dying testament, in effect. He was trying so hard to convey what he had found, how to keep AA simple. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with a series of scientific things that may be of interest to scientists but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here consists of two things, love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and tried to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room in the world like it who doesn't know exactly what he was talking about. We're all very good when things are going our way and things are fine. But let us be threatened or somebody hurt our feelings and on and on. And finally he said, none of us would be here if someone hadn't taken the time to take us to a few meetings, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it, when we felt bad, to see to our interests. He said, let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we are too busy to help our fellow alcoholic. That is a very important part of our fellowship. And then he sat down and died shortly thereafter. But the other meeting that was made of alcoholics that day was they had six young guys, bushy-tailed. They gave them each two traditions in the long form, and they each took and tried to explain, these are not rules, these are not laws, we're trying to save A. The most telling argument, of course, we have no way to enforce them. If you break them, we can't punish you. There's no enforcement. There's no A police. Sometimes old-timers like me wish there were. But what people don't realize is you cannot be a dictator-type sponsor without the absolute 100% cooperation of the dictatee. All he has to say is, screw you. And the dictatorship is over. And that would be nice to have AA police who could come at night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a little reconditioning. But they introduced the traditions to people. And then even after all that, it looked as though it might not go through. There was some grumbling. And Bill Wilson was a great man, but he was a man. And he realized that it's good nip and tuck. So he said, okay, now you've heard the traditions. Any voices against it? I guess not. In the distance, you could hear a train whistle. And so they, in the next printing of the book, they condensed them. Somebody condensed them so they'd be a little more appropriate. And they put them, the long form, most of you know in the back, is the long form, which is really fleshes out the new short form. And they've been with us ever since. The only change that's been made from the first time they were condensed, the third tradition said the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. Then after that was out for a while, they began to realize nobody ever had an honest desire to stop drinking. That's what you learn after you're here a while. You come here trying to find a way you can drink and get by with it. And so they took the word honest out. And that went along with it. And so there we are, and we have a book, and we have fellowship all over, and it's just wonderful, and there's no need for anyone to ever die drunk again. And that's why it's kind of startling when you stop and think that in America today, where there's more AA, more sober AAs, more ability to get to AA than any place in the history of the world, it's estimated that well over 90% of alcoholics still die drunk in America, or as a direct result of drinking. Now, why would that be? It's not necessary. It's not necessary at all. And I suppose it's because I see people die from quite often. And I've seen them at the top of the scale and the bottom of the scale. And it seems to me the bottom line is always this. But you don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. My case is different. And that is the curse of every alcoholic that ever lived, although they don't know it. So it becomes necessary to understand exactly what is the problem? What is the problem? We help people stop drinking. We help return to God. We help them show their gratitude to help others. And all the unsuccessful treatments of alcoholism over the years, and no one ever seemed to realize it, the whole history of treatment of alcoholism is based on treating drinking. From anabuse, it'll make you so sick that you won't drink. And pretty soon you forget to take your anabuse. You don't get sick. Yeah. The Keeley cure gets you sick drinking. Pretty soon you realize you're not going to get sick. Because no one ever seems to understand that what makes an alcoholic is what it does for you. Because the people who are treating alcoholics, it doesn't do for them, so they have no idea what's happening. All they know is, why are you this way? You know, there seems to be different types of alcoholics. There seems to be, by any standards, alcoholics, but they are people who, if they have something shattering happen, maybe a divorce or a threat of a divorce or a loss of a job or death in the family or something, and they'll suddenly realize the nature of what happens, and they'll quit, and they never drink again. Then there are people for whom the treatment centers were first invented to medically withdraw people who are physiologically addicted as well as psychologically, little by little, and they take them off each step of the way. They show us the carnage that's become of their life, and they get over here and thank you very much, and they quit, and they never drink again. Then there's another type of alcoholic who sees being alcoholic by known standards, and they drink and something dynamic happens, a death in the family or a divorce or threat of divorce or something, loss of a job, and they see the nature of their problem and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And there are people who come out of treatment centers knowing exactly their problem and they quit. And they eventually always drink again. And those are the alcoholics of our type. When Bill Wilson wrote the book Alcoholics Anonymous, he didn't understand all the types of alcoholics, but he knew the kinds that had been the problem to mankind for the existence of mankind. And again he writes in the book, alcoholics of our type. He wasn't exactly what sure that was, but he knew the kind who could not stay sober. No matter what happened, they could not stay sober. And these alcoholics of our type are the ones that have baffled families and friends and doctors and lawyers and judges and ministers and priests and everybody for eternity. If you be an alcoholic, there aren't very many people in this room, I am sure, who have not seen that look of, oh, how could you, after you'd promised to stay sober and got drunk again. Oh, I'm so tired of that look. Oh, you promised, and you were doing so well. And there's no answer. Just leave me alone. There's no answer to that because you feel as bad as they do almost. I have no explanation for it. I was in and out of AA for 10 years because I knew all about it. I could quote the book. I knew all about it. But I never seemed to be able to understand, make people understand my problem is not really alcohol. My problem is I have a lot of funny feelings and emotions and very intense and I feel bad sometimes. I don't like things and When I stay sober too long, it's almost as though somebody sneaks into my bedroom in the night and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning, they start to tighten it. And then comes the restlessness, the irritability. The world gradually becomes an ugly black and white place, and I don't like people in this place and thing. And I found out when I was 15, a ship in Pearl Harbor, in the beginning of the Second World War, somebody got me to drink some whiskey that I finally held down, and I realized that's how you get rid of those feelings. And it stayed with me all my life. And I don't explain to people. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I'm not drink because I'm a drunk. I drink because maybe I'm too sensitive, but I would never say that out loud to anybody because that's not a manly thing to say. I just say, keep your nose out of my business. And then sometimes I drink too much and people think I have a drinking problem. And I know I don't. So I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to discover that I had been repressed as a child. That's why I drank too much. And I was glad to find that out. I remember telling several arresting officers that fact. They were less than charmed. And I stood in a street corner in Los Angeles. I found myself, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission. I said, and stay out of here, you troublemaker. I tried to explain to them, I'm not a troublemaker. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very weekend in Life and Time and Saturday Evening Post and The New Yorker. I've had my picture in The New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in The New York Times? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. But if a guy would have come up to me that morning and put a lie detector in my arm and said, are you an alcoholic? I'd have said, no, not really. And that wouldn't have quivered an inch. Because I've had a lot of problems, but no one seems to understand. And I think that's the basic cause. And it isn't being on Skid Row, does it? A few years ago, our friend Maurice called me up and said, we have this very world-famous award-winning writer, bad drunk. Let's go call him. We went up to Hollywood Hills, and the butler let us into the inside maid who let us into the big room, big white room, and awards and theater awards and Academy Awards. And it was just everything. And just everything is in white perfect. Oh. And over the corner is a big bed, and crouching in the bed, just a little man crying, and he had his teeth out so he wouldn't choke on his teeth. And he told us he'd been sober 12 years, and he doesn't really think he's an alcoholic, and he knows he is, and all these problems. So, anyway, we got taken to meetings, and And after 2 or 3 months, he started to feel pretty good. After 5, 6 months or so, he was really doing quite well. One day, Maurice called me and said, "Well, Bill said that he's not going to go to meetings again for a little while." I said, "Why?" He said, "I don't know. Call him up." And I called him up. I said, "Bill, what is this?" He said, "Well, my psychiatrist thinks I'm becoming too dependent on AA." I said, "Exactly, that you're supposed to." He said, "No, I don't think you understand. It's a little different when you're a writer. And alcohol is not the problem with me like it is with many of you." And that was on Friday. And on Saturday morning, Sunday morning, picks the Times. William Inge takes a pistol, puts his mouth, and blows top of his head off. He thought it through and decided he should be dead. Now, we wouldn't call that a death from alcoholism, but it sure as hell is. Now, why is all this going on? Why should that be? And I remember, because it's just almost impossible to understand that nature of alcoholism. When I was new, I finally got a job when I was in 1960 as a beginning writer in a medical corporation. I'd been a busboy and a dishwasher and I was 2 years sober and I was going to make my move. I still didn't have any front teeth. I got them kicked out in Phoenix in 1958. But I'd learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people didn't know they thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I remember in 1961 reading in the Journal of the American Medical Association the first full-page ad I ever saw addressed to doctors talking about how to treat alcoholics. It said, "Doctors, at last you can treat alcoholics without fear of side effect. A new drug." And I thought, where was that when I needed it? And it had such a nice name, too. It spelled out freedom. It was called Librium. Oh, man. And about a year later, of course, the first Librium survivors start coming back to AA. "I'd like to get my chip tonight, if you could tell me where the podium is." In the mid-60s, I always like to read these things. In the mid-60s, there was a guy, a doctor down in Albuquerque. He got a big article in the Times about it. He was treating alcoholics, had found a new way to treat alcoholics. When you were really drunk, your family would bring you to him, and he would take movies of you. Vomiting, peeing in your pants, whatever it might be. Then the next time you felt like drinking, you'd go to his office, and he'd run this film for you and say, "Is this the way you want to be?" And he had all kinds of success. And unfortunately, eventually it got inconvenient to stop by his office for I've seen that film twice. Screw that, you know. One of my all-time favorites was right out this way. You know, the Seventh-day Adventists are death on drinking. And I'm good, but at the White Memorial Hospital, there's a page and a half article on the treatment that is at last saving alcoholics. That was the late 60s, I guess. And it was out this way, Redlands, I guess, wherever White Memorial Hospital is. But anyway, they had a ward that they turned into a bar room, a real bar, with a back bar and a bartender. And these guys went here, and the first morning, "You got some stuff in there like the Keeley here going to make me sick? You're going to give me some antabuse?" He said, "Not at all, pal. I give you my word, this is just regular booze, and you can have some, and don't worry about it." "Really?" They give him a drink, and he had a glass with a little string on it, or a little cord on it, so they couldn't take it back to their room, I guess. And you know, they've been giving you Seventh-day Adventists a bad rap for a long time. This would go on for days. The guy's feeling good. Come in the morning. "Hi, Jim. Give me the regular." And just as he drank it, they shoot an electric shock through that cord. "Hold the ice. Hold the ice." Then they'd give him a drink without the... That's more like it. You scared me for a minute. And turn on these poor guys, their lives, they'd be like fawns in a forest fire, you know. Finally come in and say, "You want a drink?" "Yeah, I guess so." Finally, the day came where they... "You want a drink?" "No, I don't believe I do." Now, if they did that for 5 days, they were released as cured. And a big article about it. And, of course, about a year or two later, somebody did a follow-up, and they're all drunk. Most of them hadn't got beyond the first bar where they didn't have any cords on the glass. Most of you remember, I think, if you're old enough, in 1971 or 72, the think tank in Santa Monica that had an article, Alcoholics Can Drink Again. It made the front page of papers all over the world, boy. I'll tell you, I watched people leave AA on account of it. And the Rand Corporation, big article. And they did follow up. They said that there was a way to drink again. Some people couldn't, but most people could. And they didn't lose a single patient. They did follow up. And about 3 years later, this doctor in North Carolina did follow up on them, and they were all drunk, too. But I said to this one guy, Rand, I said, you say you did follow up. What'd you do? He said, well, we called them and asked them how they were doing. Did you see some guy? Yeah, still doing all right. Then they have had movements, and one of my favorites is, a couple of years ago, there was this thing sweeping the country called moderation management, where alcoholics can drink again. I don't know if you remember that summer, in the early part of June that year, they had a thing on 2020 on AA, where some psychiatrist just ripped into it as a cult. And a blah, 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 blah. But by an odd coincidence, later A&E, about 2 weeks later, had a special they'd been working on for a year to do. And they interviewed 4 or 5 AA members around the country. I don't know if any of you saw it. I was one of those 4 or 5 members. Maybe now you remember me. But one of the people he interviewed was the founder of Moderation Management. And she showed her book. Yes, this is my book. We have quite an organization. And I used to be an AA, and AA seems to, I suppose, be necessary for some people, but I seem to be doing well. By the time it aired in June, she was in the Seattle, in the Washington State Penitentiary for vehicular manslaughter, killing 2 people in a crosswalk while so drunk she couldn't walk. So she, there's an article in the paper I saw later that said she promised she was going back to AA. And I wanted to call her and say, we're just sick with excitement that you're coming. There seems to be no way to do it. And it's just remarkable. And yet, you know, when Bill Wilson wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, when it first came out, the 12th step read a little differently than it reads now. He based it on his own experience. He said, 12th step, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics to practice these principles in all our affairs. They said, Bill, we didn't have any spiritual experience. You're the only one who had a spiritual experience. And you'd never result of these steps. You got in Towns Hospital before you ever heard of that thing. How do you explain that? And they had no idea how to explain it. Fortunately, the book didn't sell, so they had a lot of time to think about it. But they came upon a glimmer of an idea, which I think has firmed up over the years, to is quite clear to us now. That something Dr. Jung said probably was true. You know, they say, well, at least you don't need a spiritual experience like Dr. Jung said. I believe you do need a spiritual experience. I think Dr. Jung was absolutely correct. But we don't have nobody ever had a spiritual experience. How do you explain that? Because it turns out somehow, that in a way that nobody can explain, and I'm certainly not selling, that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, when taken in order with some degree of depth, does something nothing else ever done in the history of mankind. It brings about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his, home, but the way most of us get ours. Make amends to that bitch, are you crazy? And what happens? What does the spiritual experience consist of? It consists of a change of perception of the same facts, of the same things look different. And when you stop and think about it, what is the purpose of drinking for people like me, and I presume like you? It changes my perception of things as I see them. It changes my relationship to the world around me. You could really say that the 12 steps, in a sense, do very, very slowly what alcohol does fast. But one of the hardest things for alcoholics to understand, it took me almost my life. I died once and they had to bring me back to my life, and I still didn't believe it. But the nature of the problem is this. The problem here is not alcohol. It is something that sounds like alcohol, and a lot of people talk about drinking, but it is called alcoholism. Now you say, well, that's the same thing. That's semantics. Don't give us those semantics. It sounds like semantics, but it really isn't. It's the most critical thing I know about recovery. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. And some alcoholics can do that. And some drinkers can do that. Alcoholics of our type discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on our lives other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. In fact, some doctors say that alcoholics sometimes can get to a point where they literally have to drink to protect their sanity. And then you drink, and what's the purpose of drinking? The purpose of drinking is in two or three or four or five drinks to change my perception of reality. Remember, I was telling my sponsor, he was going through this at length interminably, and I said, but I'm not one of these guys that gets drunk and goes to Hong Kong and rapes nuns and holds up banks. I'm a guy that's just been hurt a lot. I'm kind of a victim now that I think about it. He says, it doesn't mean that. It means when you take two or three or four or five drinks, you may go home and go to bed. You may go to Mexico. You may fall in love with an 89-year-old woman on a walker and stalk her. Just means your perceptions are going to change. I said, well, what's so wrong with that? He said, because after a while, if it does this for you, eventually you no longer control what's going to happen when you start drinking. And every time out, you start to play Russian roulette, although you don't know it. And so there's a lot of empty shells in there, especially when you're young and strong. Click. What a night. Click. Boom. Jesus. Staying out of that place. Click. You know. But as you get older, some sinister force puts more and more shells in that baby, that's all. And they wind up like you, kid. Boom. Jesus. Boom. Boom. There's a click in here somewhere. Boom. Yeah. It doesn't make really difference how much you drink. It's what it does for you. Because it will do nothing to you if it doesn't do something special for you. And we are surrounded by people treating us for whom it doesn't do that, and they can't have any idea what the hell, why we act the way we do. Why we do those things. Why would you do that? They can measure my drunkenness, but they can't pull me over to the side of the road, take a drop of blood, and measure my anxiety level that day. There's no white line that'll measure that I'm feeling inferior and very sad today. There's no test to touch your nose to point out that you feel unloved and you got to have some love and you don't know what to do about it. And you find out these are the things that drinking helps. And I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because you don't understand. Eventually it gets to be all I know what to do is to drink almost. And drinkers like us are not really the problem. We talked about this before, you know, Christmas time, they have these stops along the road where they're going to catch drunken drivers. They're not trying to catch people like you and me. We know how to drink. They're trying to catch amateurs coming home from a Christmas party. People like you and I are decent people. We stand behind them and say, hurry up there for Christ's sake. You know. Interesting when you stop thinking about, we make alcohol and alcoholics kind of a mysterious thing. Remember listening to a very well-placed doctor talk about nothing mysterious. As you drink alcohol, the level of the blood, it affects your motor areas one by one. It can be measured. That's why you can know how much alcohol in your blood you shouldn't be able to drive. The first motor area to be hit by drinking is speech. That doesn't mean you can't talk. It means you just get a slight slur. Most people don't notice it. Your sponsor will, but nobody else does. Then you drink more, and it affects your equilibrium and your spatial. You find you can do a lot of alcohol, and you get to your sight. And your sight slurs. It doesn't mean that you just cannot quite triangulate. You just overshoot a little bit. That's why you see two of something. Jokes say there's three or four. There's only ever two. That's an overlap. And you overcome that by doing that, I guess. But you can keep drinking beyond that. But then the body will stop you. The body will not let you drink anymore. Alcoholism is really a funny thing. The body will make you stop. The body will fight to preserve itself. It'll do everything it can to preserve itself. It'll make you stop. It'll pass you out because the next area to hit is breathing. If you get there, you might die from it. That's why when kids on a dare drink a bottle of whiskey or something, that's why they die. Not because it burned their stomach out. It went right up to their breathing apparatus and they died. And the only thing that saves alcoholics, everything that kills alcoholics, this body tries to save you, and the brain tells you, no, it's okay. It isn't the way it looks. And you keep going. It's almost the exact opposite of cancer, where your body doesn't recognize the illness and feeds it, and your brain catches it and says, we'll cut you off and get you out. Two suicide diseases. And it's just remarkable. And that's why it's so hard to convey to people, because they are so sure. You don't know what I'm talking about. You know, the analogy I think about sometimes, we have an AA. For hundreds of years, the worst disease known, the most lethal, was smallpox. I'm glad to see they're talking about it again now, that maybe comes more from Iraq. But smallpox, they had no idea what germs were, bacteria, nothing. Just, you got sick, and God is punishing this city, and God is punishing this city, and God is punishing London. And in the early 1700s, an English doctor named Edward Jenner stumbled onto a funny thing. Girls who milk cows didn't get smallpox. Now, why the hell would that be? And then he found out there were girls who milked cows. But there was a group of them who didn't. And he tried to examine them. Where did they come from? What did they do? Do they have different cows? And it turned out they all had something called cowpox, a mild infection. And the milkers who got smallpox hadn't had cowpox. So apparently having cowpox would keep you getting smallpox. That's stupid. There's no connection. But he bought a little 9-year-old boy named Jimmy Phipps. And he bought him and took him to where the girls had cowpox. And he didn't know how to transfer sickness. So he just cut a little slash to his arm and took a stick and took some pus and blood and rubbed it in there. And Jimmy Phipps got sick and got well again from cowpox. Then he took him to where the people are dying of smallpox. Cut a little slash in his arm, took a stick, got some pus and blood, and rushed it in there. And Jimmy Phipps got very sick and got well again. And that day they discovered how to stop smallpox. You give people cowpox. In fact, here's an interesting little thought. The word vaccination comes from the Latin vaccus, injection of the cow. That's what vaccination technically means. But now they know this. But even so, people wouldn't accept. I'm not going to take cowpox. That's ridiculous. Has nothing to do with it. That's ridiculous. People died. A lot of people died, but some people survived. It wasn't until about 200 years later they found how the germs and bacteria and so on, how cowpox set up a series of counter battles against smallpox so you wouldn't get it. But they had to go for 200 years without finding out why. I've always been my feeling someday some crazed physician or specialist will come out of his laboratory and say, I found it. I wouldn't believe it to be true. But a series of 12 simple actions taken under the duress of a crazed dictatorial guider sets up a series of serotonins in the cerebral cortex that makes it unnecessary to drink. No, doctor. It'll be too late for us. We'll be dead. And so we're stuck in the position of ourselves and doing with others, saying, take the cowpox. Who cares what you think? Take the cowpox! But that's really what AA boils down to. Because these 12 steps bring about an evolving spiritual experience. The best experience I know about, you know, when I was brand new in AA and all the years before that, there wasn't any treatment centers anywhere in the world. There were no treatment centers. There was Shire's Dryer over the valley, which is a sanitarium where people would take them and dry them out. And as AA went along, eventually we got some treatment centers. And the old-timers all, you know, oh, what the hell is that? What is this crap? Parlor alcohol crap. Come on, get out of here. Come on. But they flourished. By the 70s, they were in full cry. God, they were everywhere. The chains and the government's pouring out money. It's just wonderful. And little by little, the chains started to fall away. And pretty soon, a lot of them were broken. And it turned out to me, I always hated treatment centers because I was taught to hate treatment centers. I'm very tolerant coming in here and all today. But over the years, I discovered there are good treatment centers and bad treatment centers. Good treatment centers are certainly a wonderful thing, and bad treatment centers are evil. And the analogy I thought about is this. Why would an alcoholic go to a treatment center when he can go to AA? Why spend $20,000 when he can go free down here? And it's like, if I would go down to the beach, want to go to Catalina, Santa Monica, and there was a little skiff, little men in neat white uniforms, smells of food coming out the galley, everything wonderful. Do you want to go with us? We're the SS treatment center. What other choices do I have? Those men there, there are two guys in the tall grass saying, you want to ride with us? We're from AA. We got an invisible boat. So you jump in the SS, and they do exactly what they say they're going to do. They get you dry, and they feed you, and they teach you about how to live in the water, and it's just wonderful. The only trouble is you just get out of sight of land, and they say, well, we have to turn back now. But we're a long way from Catalina. What do we do now? You're in good shape. Swim like a sumbitch. And you may swim. And here comes these two guys floating above the water in their invisible boat. Nope. You want to ride, pal? I'm not that sick. Till you're almost dead, they say, you want to ride? Yeah, I want to ride. And they throw you in the boat. Oh, God, there's no boat here. We're just floating. This is nonsense. What do you want me to do? Grab an oar and row. Finally, you're about dead. You want to row? What do you want me to do now? Grab an oar and row. You crazy bastards. And the beauty of it is, when you start to row, the boat appears. But it doesn't appear until you begin to row. And countless people have drowned because there's no boat there. And some of us have been lucky enough to row even though there was no boat there. And as you row, the boat appears. Sometimes pursuit gets bigger and lovely. Better. Who wants to go to Catalina? Let's just row this thing. And it's just great. And it's a wonderful change of life. One problem, turns out, for people of our type, if you stop rowing long enough, the boat starts to disappear again. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of people like you and me who went back in the water and most of them drowned there. Interesting thought. The book Alcoholics Anonymous, the big red copy of the big book, written in 1939, written 38, print 1939, had some wonderful stories in the back, some inspirational stories. Most of those people died drunk. Most of the people who had stories in the second edition died drunk. Not because they were bad people, not because they didn't think terribly wrong, but they hadn't yet learned that this is not a dynamic disease that you get over from. It's more like a chronic disease that you must continue to treat. It's a lot of these great guys that I knew. One of the men that saved my life, my sponsor, eventually got died and drunk because he stopped doing the things. But if you keep rowing, the boat seems to stay there. That's what sponsors are for. They come by sometime and you say, I'm not making any progress. Well, you seem to have your oar upside down. How's that? Oh, yeah, I know that. Yeah. And we share with one another. We share with one another. Because the bottom line is this. For whatever reason, whatever psychological reason, psychiatric reason, any psychological profile, the fact remains that I got to a point in my life and spent much of my life there, unable to live with the conflicts that irritated, made me sad and lonely and afraid and desperate. And I found that drinking healed that. And for me to just get sober means now I'm now sober, living with fears and despairs and hopelessness and desperation. So the point of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to get sober. People talk about, just get sober, go to meetings. That's baloney. That's death. You must do things that will change your perception of reality. Alcoholics Anonymous today is exactly the same thing it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And that is the birth of sobriety, I firmly believe. You know, I'm in a situation that I'm sure none of you are in. Maybe the Monsignor's been there. Maybe Jim West. But when I go to work in the morning, I do something none of you do. I get out of my car, and I step over the bodies of men and women and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction. I go to my office, spend all day working, come home at night, step over the bodies of dying men and women and children, get in my car and drive home, dying from alcoholism, drug addiction. You think, well, why don't you help them? And when I first went there years ago, I spent all my days trying to help them. You'd think, well, I guess God just means them to die. I don't think that's true. When I first came here, I don't want to get off on some talk about higher powers, but when I first came here, I could not accept God because I was raised in a very strict Lutheran church and I was a sinner and there was no returning to God. It took me a long time. My sponsor became my first higher power, and then AA was my higher power. Then I took enough action, so at least my perceptions changed enough, so I was able to pray, and then some people, Chuck Seen, some other guys, got me to believe that God loved me. No more than you, no less than you. And of course they say, well, if you believe God loves everybody the same, how do you explain that guy dying on the street there and you're walking down there in a new suit? And I'll tell you the answer. The bottom line is this. You can take psychological profiles. You can take economic profiles. You can take racial profiles. You can take anything. But the bottom line, I believe, is this. The difference between them and me, they are unwilling to take actions they don't agree with yet, and they're going to die from it, as I would have died on that very same sidewalk where I lay 44 years ago with knowing I was not an alcoholic. Because that's what it's all about. The purpose here, it's nice to get sober, and no matter how much your perceptions change, there's one thing else I should say. No matter how hard you work your program, no matter what you do, you never rise above human being. We hear people all the time say, I no longer have anger. I no longer have rage. Lay a cup of coffee down in front of them, see what happens. The point is not that we get rid of emotions, but we see them and deal with them and head them off the path sometime before they happen. You never become wonderful here, but you can become a person with a changed perception most of the time. I've been sober, as I say, 44 years. I still occasionally have days that I know by noon, this is a terrible day. Nothing will ever change. I spend the rest of the day just saying, come on, midnight. Come on, midnight. But I know that happens to human beings. But I also know that I've had a change of perception that had taken me once upon a time committed to the Texas State Insane Asylum for an indefinite to life. It's a successful suicide, brought back to life to be put into shock treatments. Been in jail 30-some times. Been in some bad situations all my life. And to find myself living in a degree of comfort. You say, well, sure, you're on Skid Row. No wonder you're so... That is what AA is about, or alcoholism about. Over the years, I've sponsored some exotic people, the guy that put the flag on the moon, and one of the most famous directors in the world, and Hollywood directors, and a guy who's still making $1 million on his bottom year. What do we all have in common? We weren't all thrown out of the midnight mission with our teeth kicked out. We got to a point where drinking was no longer a viable alternative, and sobriety was no longer a viable alternative. And there you are, and that's why we are here. And I hope we stay here. Thank you.